You're on Nightlife. Now, look, the era when the worst thing that could happen to a young single girl was to find herself pregnant isn't that far behind us in the past. And there'll be some Australian women, perhaps you, still living with the trauma of having to give up the child that you gave birth to. Some of you may even be the children that were forcibly taken from their mothers. Now, writer Lynn Yowett has explored the story of some of these young women in her new book. It's called The Hollow Girl. It's a crime fiction book set in regional Victoria in the 60s and 70s. The story centres around investigations into the murder of one of the nurses who worked at a so-called refuge for young women in crisis. It's Lynn's second book. Her debut novel, The Silent Listener, won the 2022 Indie Book Award for Debut Fiction. It was a finalist in the UK People's Book Prize and shortlisted for three other national awards in Australia. And Lynn is here with us on Nightlife tonight to be our writer. Hello, Lynn. Welcome.
Hi, Suzanne. Thank you.
So this book was inspired by a story that a friend of yours told you some years ago. Would you tell us the story that put you on the path to writing The Hollow Girl?
Yeah. So my friend Beatrice one day said to me, can we go and have a coffee? I've got something I want to tell you. So off we went to a cafe, sat down, got our coffees. And as she was sort of stirring her coffee, she said, okay, so this thing that I have to tell you about myself, after I tell you, I don't think you'll want to be friends with me anymore. And I have to say, I honestly looked at her and thought, has she killed somebody? So I waited for her to tell me her story. And she said, when I was 15, I got pregnant and I was sent to a home for unmarried mothers and I had the baby and the baby was adopted out. And I waited then for the next part of the story, which would be, what did you do that would destroy our friendship? And that was it. There was nothing else to her story, just that this had happened to her a long time ago. So I said, why do you think this would destroy our friendship? Why would I want to stop being friends with you because this awful thing happened to you? And so she told me that when she fell pregnant, her family kind of disowned her. Her friends didn't want to have anything to do with her. The school she went to formally expelled her. And she was sent to this home where she was treated really badly. And she and the other young girls there were told that they weren't fit to be mothers, they were scum of the earth, they were sinful, appalling, morally deficient, etc. And she had lived with this shame for decades and honestly believed that if she told people about this story, this part of her life, that people would turn against her. And so, of course, it didn't ruin our friendship. And over the years, I found out more and more about the experience. And when I had to write a second book, I was talking to her one day about it, which we did from time to time. And I just had this idea that I was going to combine the fact that she had told me that I wouldn't want to be friends with her anymore and the experiences in the home with my initial thought that she might have killed somebody. So I guess I've sort of combined those two ideas into the book where it's set in a home for unmarried mothers and there is a murder.
Mm. Lynn, just extraordinary thinking about Beatrice. I mean, was this in the 1960s, like when your book is sent, that she had been sent to one of these places?
Yes, her baby was born in the 1960s, yeah.
Just extraordinary to think that sense of shame, even in all the years in which, you know, as a society, we've debated this and we've said that shame was ill-placed and we shouldn't have been doing that, that she's still carrying that.
And look, when I started writing the book and people started asking me, so what's your next book about? And I would say it's set in a home for unmarried mothers in the 1960s and 70s and there's a murder there. I couldn't believe how many people said to me, oh, my mother, grandmother, great aunt, next door neighbour's mother, husband's mother, whatever, was sent to, and everyone said, one of those places. It was just extraordinary how many people knew people who had been there. And then, of course, every now and then, which you alluded to in your introduction, every now and then someone would pause and say, oh, yes, I was one of those women sent to those places. And some of those women, as did Beatrice, were really generous in sharing their stories with me and telling me what had happened to them and their personal circumstances, along with things like whether they had ever reunited with their child or not. Sometimes it was a happy, if you can call it a happy ending, lots of many years of lost family relationships there. But sometimes it was a sad ending because sometimes the child didn't want to reunite or didn't want to meet the parent. So it was kind of a tough form of research to hear these stories. But as I said, very brave and generous of many people to tell me their personal experiences.
And Lena, there's solid figures on how many young women that actually happened to.
Solid's an interesting question, interesting word to use. Yes, there are figures around this, but no one can be entirely sure because the institutions that these women were sent to sometimes weren't obliged to or didn't keep accurate records. So we can never be entirely sure of how many women and babies were separated. But a Senate inquiry did suggest that it was possibly as many as 250,000 women and babies. And I did some maths before I did a talk a few weeks ago, and I worked out that that is one baby a day for 685 years. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of no wonder that when I was talking to people, I kept encountering people who said, oh, I know someone, or I was one of them. And occasionally someone would say to me, including one of my friends, I was born in one of those homes. So, yeah, very tragic chapter in Australia's history.
Lynn Yowett is my guest. Her new book is The Hollow Girl, and she's with us on Nightlife tonight to talk to us about it. So in The Hollow Girl, the place where your character, Jane McAvoy, ends up in 1961, Harrowford Hall, is just terrible. So what were these facilities like? You know, were there many across the country? You know, what can you tell us about what would have happened to someone like Jane once they arrived there?
Unfortunately, it is a really sad story. Most girls were removed from their families, often taken a long way away from their hometowns into places like Harrowford, which is totally fictional, and set outside Horsham in Victoria. And a lot of them were made to work in laundries. Some people may be familiar with the Magdalen laundries that we know about in Ireland. They were also in Australia. I chose not to focus mine around the Catholic Church's institutions. I didn't want to make it a religious issue, but there were state-run institutions as well and privately run institutions, and mostly the girls were treated really badly. In some cases, before they went to the homes, they were sent to private homes to care for the younger children there or to work as a maid or a servant, a cleaner or a cook or something like that. And the ones that were sort of governesses of the younger children, when they subsequently went to the homes for unmarried mothers, that was where they were told they weren't fit to be mothers, they weren't fit to be looking after children, even though they spent the last maybe 2 months actually being a governess of sorts for other people's children. And so the days were long and hard, the rules were plentiful, and it was a pretty miserable existence. From stories that people have told me and that I've also read, the girls were very rarely told anything about what it was like to be pregnant, what they could expect physically or emotionally, and very often they weren't told about what would happen during the birth, and they certainly weren't told that their child was going to be taken away from them. Some of them did sign consent to adoption forms, mostly under duress. So I'll just say that my friend Beatrice did sign a consent to adoption form, but she did not consent to have her child adopted. So there were aspects of her story like that provided me as a crime psychological thriller writer, lots of fodder for building in lies and red herrings and manipulation of the truth that hopefully also, I'm going to say, I guess, deceives or tricks readers into thinking that one thing is the case when actually something else is the case. So there are a lot of twists in the book.
Yeah, you had me going until the end. I'll tell you that.
That's good. That's good. I'm very pleased to hear it. And I will say every single twist in The Hollow Girl is based on a true story. So everything that happens that you then subsequently read about and think, oh, what? I had no idea that was going to happen, or I had no idea that was the truth. It is something that happened to at least one person and probably many, possibly thousands of women.
So, Lynn, at the sheer numbers of girls who were, you know, sent to these so-called refuges during this time, who was driving that? I mean, was it parents, mothers? Was it something broader in society? Was it doctors saying, you know, perhaps your daughter needs to go there?
It was a little bit of all of those. It was this, collective moral certainty that these women had done something terrible. So let's just digress a little bit and say no one ever said anything about the men who, or young men maybe, who had contributed to the pregnancy.
I think they definitely contributed.
Yep, that's right. And we don't have a term that for those men. We have this unmarried mothers term and many other really awful derogatory terms for the women, but we don't even have the term, for example, unmarried father. It doesn't exist in our vocabulary. And so the men are apparently free of any guilt, certainly free of any shame or having to endure any consequences. I should be a little bit fair and say some of the fathers wouldn't have known that their girlfriends were pregnant. The girls were sort of whipped away fairly quickly often, and certainly they wouldn't have the family and the girl wouldn't have wanted the boy or her family to know. It was a result of everybody in our society seemingly convinced that these women were sort of the lowest of the low and that the best thing to do was to hide it. So the best thing to do for the family was to hide it, have the girl sent away, tell stories that maybe she's gone to help a sick aunt somewhere or she's gone to work somewhere, anything but utter the truth. And everybody went along with it, parents, churches, schools, communities, societies, the government, doctors, certainly. And it was supposedly done to protect the reputation of the girl and the family. And in the reading that I did about what happened in America was that prior to World War II, these homes really were refuges for women who had found themselves pregnant. But after World War II, and I believe this is the case in Australia as well, there was an increased demand for children to adopt. And I should just perhaps emphasise that we're only talking about white children. This is quite different to the Stolen Generation. And I wouldn't want the two chapters of history to get confused. I'm definitely talking only about the white babies that were separated from white mothers. So there was this thing that these girls can't possibly look after their children. We have a growing demand for children to be adopted because we've developed this idea of the nuclear family and every family must have a white picket fence and a sunbeam mixmaster and 2.4 children. And if for some reason you couldn't have your 2.4 children, then here was a supply that was being provided by these young pregnant women. So they were sent away and readily became the provider of babies that white people wanted to adopt. In America, they call this era the baby scoop era because often the adopting parents were kind of literally waiting in the hallway for the child to be born, and they would come in and sort of metaphorically or even literally scoop up the baby and be gone with all the correct paperwork done, but no chance for the mother to meet the infant or hold her or develop any maternal instincts or bonding with the child, they were often whipped away very, very quickly. It was, just
awful.
Aline,
was it, I mean, with the adopted parents, presumably, were they paying? I mean, was this an industry which was turning for profit in some ways?
I don't want to say that it absolutely was, but there are other people out there who will say that. I don't think I can claim to be enough of an expert to say that. In my novel, it's certainly a possibility, and I think that there were always probably some fees paid, some exchange of money to cover medical costs. Often adopting parents were asked to cover medical costs of the mother or for the institution having looked after the child for a period of time. So it's a little bit of a fuzzy area, and because theoretically it would have been very illegal to actually pay for a child, it's not something for which records were kept. So I guess I don't want to say definitely this happened, but I also don't want to say it definitely did not happen.
Lynn Yowett is with me. Her new book is called The Hollow Girl. Institutions like Harrowford Hall, Lynn, are there many still standing?
Not that I know of. And if they are, they've certainly been repurposed, probably into Airbnbs or little niche guest houses, that sort of thing. I don't think that they are. If anybody knows of any, I'd love to find out.
No, we'd be very interested to hear if you do know of something like that. 0467 922 702. You're on Nightlife on this Friday night with Suzanne Hill. Are you aware, Lynn, whether there was any particular development that brought an end to this practice of sending away and sequestering these young women? Or was it something that sort of changed gradually? Because, I mean, obviously this does not happen anymore.
No. So there are a few things that happened socially, I guess, in the late 60s and early 70s that brought about the close of most of these homes. So there are things like the introduction of the pill and making it readily available even to single women, because for a while doctors were happy to prescribe it to married women but not to single women, but eventually it became available to single women. The attitude towards abortion started to change, and it was also more readily available. There were a lot of people protesting against it, of course, but it was easier for young pregnant women to have an abortion. And then there were sort of social mores that were changing. One, maybe there was a little bit more acceptance that there were two people involved in the event. I know certainly when I was at high school in the mid-70s, one of our classmates got herself pregnant, which was the term that people used, got herself pregnant, and she was 17 and so was her boyfriend. They did actually get married and move away from the area. So I think there was more of that kind of thing happening. And then also I think a lot of parents started to reject the idea that their daughter was the lowest of the low simply because she'd had intercourse with someone, and that maybe the parents could support the child both emotionally and financially. I'm sure lots of listeners will know about the fact that a lot of parents of these girls took in the child and raised it as if the child was one of their own. So the child would grow up believing she had an older sister. The older sister was actually her mother, and the people she believed were her parents were actually her grandparents. And that had happened to a friend of mine as well. So I think there were a lot of attitudes that were changing. And then, as I said, things like medical issues around doctors being less perhaps judgmental, providing the pill, providing abortions.
Lynn Yowett is here. So I want to talk about your other character, main character, Detective Sergeant Eleanor Smith, because she's in 1973 and she's assigned to her first homicide case. This is when, of course, one of the nurses who worked at the refuge is murdered. She is a lone woman officer in a sea of male colleagues. I imagine female detectives were relatively far and few between. Did you do some research into what it would have been like to be a woman in the force at that time?
Yeah, I did a little bit of research. I have to say I used a lot of imagination as well. And so any male detectives out there who don't like the male detective character that I wrote, feel free to contact me. But Eleanor is definitely one of very few female detectives in Victoria. And it was a fact that there were very few. There were very few police officers at all. I think in 1973, it was something like 4% of the force were female, and it was far fewer female detectives than that. So yeah, Eleanor's got a bit of an uphill battle ahead of her to convince her boss that she can in fact solve a murder, and to counteract the misogyny that she's confronted with.
The Silent Listener, your first book, was very successful. I mean, I mentioned it won a number of prizes. Did you find yourself under pressure to create a worthy follow-up novel, the famous, you know, second book?
Do I wish you'd asked me that question or not, Suzanne? I did. And I will say that I wrote a book. I'm going to say this. I wrote a book which I thought was going to be my second book, and it was based on Beatrice's story, and it did have Jane, the 14-year-old who gets sent to Hereford Hall, and she has the baby and she does not go home with the baby, so all of that was there. But I'm just going to say it wasn't a very good book, and after I'd finished it, I knew it wasn't very good, and I sent it to my publisher warning her that it wasn't very good, and she got back to me the very next day and basically said, I agree with you, you're right. So I decided I would throw it out and start again, and I did do that. And I think it was partly because I did feel this pressure to create something that was going to be as successful as The Silent Listener, and I don't know that I was conscious of the pressure. I just thought, yes, I think I can do this again. It will be okay. I've got a really good idea. But, you know, sometimes the idea in your head doesn't translate to something terrific on paper or on screen. And it didn't first time round. So, and it was interesting because my publisher said to me in the conversation that we had about the terrible manuscript, she said, I know you can't rewrite The Silent Listener, but what we want you to do is rewrite The Silent Listener. So it was a really interesting thing. I had to rethink a lot of what I had done with the first attempt at The Hollow Girl. And I think what I hadn't done enough of in that was keep it dark. So The Silent Listener is dark, and I am going to say so is The Hollow Girl. Hopefully both of them have moments of humour and lightness and even a little bit of beauty and wonder at certain aspects of life or the world. But they are dark and they do deal with difficult topics. And I think I had tried to veer away a little bit from that too much in the terrible manuscript. So anyway, got back to what I know best.
You've been very hard on yourself there. I mean, how do you, as a writer, how do you know when you've written something terrible?
I knew it was boring.
You're right.
That's actually it was a little bit too boring and a little bit, in some parts, it was a little bit too nice. And I'm not, the reality is I'm not going to ever write a really nice, pretty, wrapped up with pink ribbons at the end type of book. So I think I just have to, I think I've realised that now, and I just have to stick to what I'm hopefully good at.
Well, I reckon the second edition's a cracker of the second attempt. I really enjoyed it. Didn't find it boring at all. So thanks, Lee. Well, congratulations on it. And thank you for being here on Nightlife tonight to tell us a bit about the story behind The Hollow Girl.
That's great. Thank you, Suzanne.
That's Lynn Yowett, who is the author of The Hollow Girl.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.